There's an incredible strength when our democracy is intact.
Really? I wouldn't know. But I'd love to find out.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Oh, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio, Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, as well as other fine terrestrial affiliates across California, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Ohio, New York, Louisiana, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Arkansas, Washington State, Virginia, West Virginia, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, not to mention all of your favorite podcast sites and streaming across the world on the internet, so the Progressive Voices channel and other fine streaming affiliates. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today.
We got a lot of show today.
Yeah, we got a lot to get to. Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
How are you?
Doing all right.
Good. Just all right. All right. I feel you. Before we get started, maybe I can help. Maybe I can help, Desi Doyen. Before we get started today, here's a bit of encouraging thoughts from our friend Allison in my old home state of Missouri. She is a longtime Bradcast listener. She was kind enough to call into the show for the first time a few weeks ago.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, she sent an email yesterday to me via bradcast@bradblog.com. She writes, "Hi, Brad. My daughter listens to the show with me sometimes. She's 10 and in fifth grade." So we are finally reaching our target audience, it sounds like. I'm sorry, Allison, about Desi Doyen's potty mouth. Anyway, Allison writes, she likes the music for The Open and The Green News Report.
Yay.
Thank you, Allison's daughter. Anyway, she continues, I told her what you wrote on the Brad blog yesterday, asking folks whether you have helped remind other people to vote, etc. And she was very excited because she has actually done that.
Oh, good.
Which is awesome. Allison's daughter, way to go. Allison writes, my mom has been writing postcards for democracy. Joyce Vance, the former federal prosecutor, wrote about it in her newsletter. So my mom signed up, says Allison. You can write postcards for tight races all over the country, she explains, adding, her daughter has written for a school board candidate in Reno, congressional districts in New York, people in Arizona and other places. It's really cool, she says. My mom got her interested, and she's written to about 15 to 20 people this week.
Wow.
Very cool. Very well done. Allison says it's a cool program. If you want to check it out at markersfordemocracy.org. Take care, Allison. Well, thank you, Allison. You are a great mom, and your daughter is already a great champion for democracy, thanks to you, as clearly your own mom is, who, by the way, also has a great daughter. So thank you all for all of that. And thank you for taking action above and beyond voting in this rather historic moment. Now, if you can just get Missouri back on the right track, I'll be really grateful, since it has clearly gone off the rails ever since I have left. And as you know, I blame myself.
Yes, but person-to-person democracy, hopefully that will help.
Always happy to hear from folks via bradcast@bradblog.com. I read them all. I try to answer most when I can, even if not on air. And thus ends the endearing, optimistic portion of today's program. Actually, that's not true. We're going to close today, if time allows, with some optimistic thoughts to help all of us get through the coming days. I've been warning, of course, for a number of months on this program that we were going to be in for a bumpy ride through Election Day and beyond Election Day, but that this moment for our nation and our world is just so critical and just so dire that we really need to step up to meet the moment. bumpy or otherwise, just like Allison and her daughter and her mother are doing. We are approaching peak bumpy ride, I think, even if we are not quite at the peak yet. But we start with a few bumps today in Arizona. For a start, Phoenix Fire Department and police officials are investigating after a U.S. Postal Service mailbox was believed to have been set on fire overnight, damaging a number of mailed-in ballots, according to ABC 15 in Phoenix. Crews were called to the USPS Osborne Station near 7th Avenue and Indian School Road around 1:30 a.m. on Thursday morning or late Wednesday night, depending on how you look at it, where a drive-up mail collection box was on fire. Firefighters say an unknown person lit a fire inside the blue drive-up collection box and then fled the area in the battleground states, lately Democratic-leaning county of Maricopa, the largest by far in the state and one that will be critical for either Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, given its size in the state, if they hope to win in that battleground this year, as Joe Biden narrowly did back in 2020. Crews were able to quickly extinguish the blaze, according to ABC 15, but investigators were later seen going through the pieces of mail that had been burned in the fire. According to fire officials, approximately 20 electoral ballots were damaged, along with additional miscellaneous mail. Phoenix Fire Department's Arson Investigation Task Force is performing criminal investigation with postal inspectors and police. A USPS spokesperson and postal inspector told ABC 15, quote, "This does not happen often and is rare, and they urged people to place mail in collection boxes before the last collection time each day," which, frankly, is something I hadn't thought about in the past. I will add that that's good advice for everyone who plans to use a USPS mailbox to mail in an absentee ballot this year. Don't, you know, put it in after the last collection time on any given day that is listed on the box. Do it before so it's not in there overnight hanging out for some jerk to come by and try to burn it down. Of course, a better idea would be to drop off that absentee ballot in person,
if you can,
at either a precinct or a voting center or at your town's or county's election headquarters, depending on what is allowed in your particular municipality. But delivering it in person is a good idea. One of the reasons I've never been a fan of absentee voting myself, unless it's absolutely necessary because you actually can't get to the polling place, you're going to be out of town, you're sick, etc., is because of concerns about what can happen to that ballot between you and its safe arrival and tabulation at the county. Sending it via the Postal Service is really one of the most precarious ways to deliver your ballot, as I see it, for a whole bunch of reasons. And this story out of Phoenix is just one of those reasons. And frankly, given the political atmosphere that we are in, it may be one to consider more than I think I have even pondered in the past. The USPS said in a statement, quote, "If you believe your mail-in ballot may have been impacted by this incident, please contact your local election office to confirm receipt and identify options for tracking your ballot." The USPS continued that the inspection service takes all reports of election offenses involving U.S. mail very seriously. Postal inspectors are immediately reviewing and addressing all complaints of impacted political or election mail. Anyone who steals, disrupts, delays, or otherwise tampers with political or election mail should know that the full investigative strength of the federal government will be directed toward them, including postal inspectors, special agents with the USPS Office of Inspector General, and the FBI, and prosecutors with the Department of Justice. This zero tolerance policy, they note, ensures that American citizens can vote with the confidence that their mail and the election two of America's most trusted institutions are free from criminal disruption. Yes, I know. I smiled when I when I referred to elections and the U.S. Postal Service as the most trusted institutions. I don't know what that says about all of the other institutions, but I hear you, Postal Service.
Yeah, and you really do not want to mess with postal inspectors. They are badass.
The Maricopa County Recorder, Stephen Richer, said, quote, "We encourage all voters who used that particular mailbox in the last 36 hours to check the status of their ballots at beballotready.vote. That's what they use in Phoenix and the surrounding areas, beballotready.vote. He says successful delivery is usually reflected on that website within 72 hours. Voters should be aware, however, that October 25 is the last day to request a replacement ballot in Maricopa. If a voter there believes they were impacted by this incident, they can learn more about it at request.maricopa.vote. And we will hope that is a very isolated incident.
yep.
But then there is this also out of Arizona today, because I told you it was going to be bumpy, especially with a guy who has told his followers that there is a, quote, enemy within that he vows, quote, retribution against, and that they are, you know, all apparently largely members of the Democratic Party or something. An Arizona prosecutor said that the man arrested in the shooting of a Democratic National Committee office in suburban Phoenix had more than 120 guns and over 250,000 rounds of ammo in his home, leading law enforcement to believe he may have been planning a mass casualty event. Good news, he was apprehended by authorities before that could happen. Maricopa County Prosecutor Nia Bhatia said at Jeffrey Michael Kelly's initial court appearance on Wednesday that federal agents told her about the large seizure made after Kelly's arrest. Scopes, body armor, and silencers were also found. A machine gun was discovered in the car he was driving.
Wow.
A machine gun? Police said the 60-year-old man allegedly fired BB pellets and then gunshots at the glass front door at the DNC office and a window of the Arizona Democrats' field office in Tempe, this was. So on the sort of the east side of Phoenix. Nobody was inside the building during the shootings in the early morning hours of September 16, September 23, and October 6. So it seems there were three different incidents at this Democratic field office, even if it hasn't gotten nearly the attention as it did when, you know, two Republicans attempted to shoot Donald Trump in recent months. The man is also accused of hanging several political signs lined with razor blades on Tuesday of this week in Ahwatukee, an affluent suburb of Phoenix, where most voters have chosen Democrats in recent elections. Authorities said he also hung plastic bags holding a white powder labeled biohazard from the signs. Authorities said the hand-painted signs were attached to palm trees and appeared to criticize Democrats and their presidential nominee, Vice President Kamala Harris. The suspect was being held now on three felony counts of acts of terrorism and four other counts related to the shootings, according to the police. His attorney says he is a retired aerospace engineer who at one time had top security clearance.
Oh, my.
But that he had no criminal record and he was not a flight risk. The Tempe location was one of 18 Harris field offices in Arizona where Democrats gathered to organize Harris campaign efforts. It was shut down after the last shooting, said police, indicating that, yep, terrorism works, doesn't it? As noted, with Trump at the top of the ticket on the Republican side, none of this really comes as a surprise. And yes, I warned it was going to be a bumpy ride, but it was time to meet the historic moment, which we will. I've also noted with some frequency in recent weeks that I'm kind of vacillating between what would be a worse outcome, Trump winning or Trump losing at this point. But I got to say, given the news of the past few days, the most dangerous outcome for our nation and the world is clearly Trump winning, even if a loss is likely to bring many more bumps in the road between Election Day and at least Inauguration Day on January 20 next year. But I've been warning, along with many others for the past year or so, even when Joe Biden was at the top of the ticket, that, yeah, democracy itself is indeed on our ballot this year in what has become a democracy versus autocracy, or democracy versus fascism, if you prefer, election. So I'm also happy to see that Kamala Harris is continuing to step up to meet the political and the historic moment, particularly in the closing days with Election Day, your last chance to do your duty by casting a ballot this year. Now just a week and change away at this point. As TPM's David Kurtz sets the scene today, Vice President Kamala Harris appears to set to close her presidential campaign with a rousing defense of American democracy and a withering indictment of Donald Trump's fascistic inclinations. A series of developments Wednesday portend a final 10-day stretch until Election Day, in which Harris more directly and powerfully confronts the Trumpian threat that she than she has to this point. In a move heavy with symbolism, Harris plans to hold a rally next Tuesday on the Ellipse in Washington, D.C., in which she will make her closing argument to the American people before presumably spending the last week of the campaign barnstorming swing states. The Ellipse, of course, is where you may remember that Donald Trump kicked off his 2021 U.S. Capitol insurrection with a speech to followers, many of them armed with weapons, telling them to, quote, fight like hell, and if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. And apparently they believed him, and they attacked the Capitol, and 140 law enforcement officials were critically injured. Several ended up dying. As Kurtz notes, taking her campaign to the side of the instigation of the January 6th insurrection is a potent reminder of the stakes of this election and a bold, confrontational, affirmative stroke reclaiming public ground on the National Mall that was soiled by Trump's infamous Stop the Steal rally. Contrast that, he notes, with Trump's planned Madison Square Garden closing event in New York City. Now, he doesn't note this, but I will. For those who may not know, Madison Square Garden is the site of a notorious Nazi rally in 1938, I believe. It was billed as, yes, a quote, America First event, as the German-American Bund, which organized the rally, used American patriotic imagery alongside Nazi symbols. It was held to promote what they called, quote, pro-Americanism at the time, America First, but it was clearly aligned with Nazi ideology and anti-Semitic views. But of course, that's just a coincidence, I'm sure, that Donald Trump has chosen to make his closing argument there. Because, you know, maybe he's really trying to win the state of New York this year. That could be what it is. In brief, midday remarks from the vice president's residence in D.C. on Wednesday, Kamala Harris directly addressed the new alarming public remarks, some of which we shared on yesterday's broadcast, made by former Trump White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, calling Trump, among other things, a fascist. In short, John Kelly, the very conservative, retired four-star U.S. Marine general who served as Donald Trump's Homeland Security chief before becoming his longest-serving chief of staff, said in those recorded remarks that Trump meets the, quote, definition of fascist, is, quote, certainly an authoritarian, quote, admires people who are dictators and prefers the dictator approach to government. He said that Trump repeatedly praised Adolf Hitler during his time in the White House and insisted that the German dictator, quote, did some good things. That Trump doesn't understand either history or the U.S. Constitution, though he frequently insisted that he knew more about the president's constitutional authority than the lawyers in the White House counsel's office did. He looked down on those who were disabled or killed on the battlefield while serving their nation, and he confirmed that Trump would frequently describe them as suckers and losers. And that, never mind his politics, many of which General Kelly might agree with, Trump simply does not have the character to serve as president of the United States, which is far more important, he said, than any particular partisan policy positions. You can get a free link at bradblog.com to that story, as we covered it yesterday, to that story over at the New York Times, so you can hear General Kelly's words on tape for yourself. But those are among the comments that Kamala Harris responded to in brief remarks outside her home at the Naval Observatory in D.C. on Wednesday.
So yesterday we learned that Donald Trump's former chief of staff, John Kelly, a retired four-star general, confirmed that while Donald Trump was president, he said he wanted generals like Adolf Hitler had. Donald Trump said that because he does not want a military that is loyal to the United States Constitution. He wants a military that is loyal to him. He wants a military who will be loyal to him personally, one that will obey his orders even when he tells them to break the law or abandon their oath to the Constitution of the United States. In just the past week, Donald Trump has repeatedly called his fellow Americans the enemy from within, and even said that he would use the United States military to go after American citizens. And let's be clear about who he considers to be the enemy from within. Anyone who refuses to bend a knee or dares to criticize him would qualify, in his mind, as the enemy within. Like judges, like journalists, like nonpartisan election officials. It is deeply troubling and incredibly dangerous that Donald Trump would invoke Adolf Hitler, the man who is responsible for the deaths of 6 million Jews and hundreds of thousands of Americans. All of this is further evidence for the American people of who Donald Trump really is. This is a window into who Donald Trump really is, from the people who know him best, from the people who worked with him side by side in the Oval Office and in the Situation Room. And it is clear from John Kelly's words that Donald Trump is someone who, I quote, certainly falls into the general definition of fascist, who in fact vowed to be a dictator on day one and vowed to use the military as his personal militia to carry out his personal and political vendettas. Donald Trump is increasingly unhinged and unstable. And in a second term, people like John Kelly would not be there to be the guardrails against his propensities and his actions. Those who once tried to stop him from pursuing his worst impulses would no longer be there, and no longer be there to rein him in. So the bottom line is this: we know what Donald Trump wants. He wants unchecked power. The question in 13 days will be, what do the American people want? Thank you.
Excellent question. That was the vice president in D.C. on Wednesday. And by the way, we've got some new examples of who Trump views as the enemy, the enemies within, coming up in a bit. But asked on Wednesday night during a CNN town hall, one that Donald Trump declined to attend himself, if she believes that Trump is a fascist herself, Harris did not miss a beat to respond unequivocally on that point.
For weeks, you have been calling Donald Trump unstable, unhinged. You've called him dangerous. You've quoted General Milley recently, who called him a fascist. Today, you quoted General Kelly, who said that Trump repeatedly praised Hitler.
Yeah.
But there are tens of millions of Americans right now who have heard all those things and they don't buy it, or even if they do, they're still going to vote for Donald Trump. He's arguably more popular now than ever. You have 13 days to go. What do you say to those voters to convince them? Because some of them are in this room.
Yes, I do believe that Donald Trump is unstable, increasingly unstable, and unfit to serve. And I don't necessarily think that everyone has heard what you and I have heard repeatedly, which is the people who know Donald Trump best, the people who worked with him in the White House, in the Situation Room, in the Oval Office, all Republicans, by the way, who served in his administration, his former chief of staff, his national security advisor, former secretaries of defense, and his vice president, have all called him unfit and dangerous. They have said explicitly he has contempt for the Constitution of the United States. They have said he should never again serve as president of the United States. We know that is why Mike Pence is not running with him again, why the job was empty. And then today we learned that John Kelly, a four-star Marine general, who was his longest-serving chief of staff, gave an interview recently in the last 2 weeks of this election talking about how dangerous Donald Trump is. And I think one has to think about, why would someone who served with him, who is not political, a four-star Marine general, why is he telling the American people now? And frankly, I think of it as he's just putting out a 911 call to the American people. Understand what could happen if Donald Trump were back in the White House. And this time, we must take very seriously those folks who knew him best and who were career people are not going to be there to hold him back.
You've quoted General Milley calling Donald Trump a fascist. You yourself have not used that word to describe him. Let me ask you tonight, do you think Donald Trump is a fascist?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
It was Kamala Harris on CNN at a town hall in Pennsylvania on Wednesday night. Writes David Kurtz today about what appears to be her closing message. Quote, I don't know if it's the winning message, he writes, but it's the right message. It's hard to imagine waking up the day after Donald Trump wins and wishing that you'd spent more time talking about inflation and economic anxiety. At least we're going to have a plain choice right in front of us, and there can be no doubt what a Kamala Harris win would mean, a rejection of fascism. Ironically, Donald Trump is also helping to make that message clear with things like that Madison Square Garden rally and comments about what he will do if he is allowed back in the Oval Office, what he will do immediately after getting back in the Oval Office. He's already told us that he plans to be a dictator on day one, but he's also now putting some meat on those authoritarian bones for those who'd like some more specific details on what that will almost immediately, if you believe Trump, look like when he returns, if he returns to the White House. Via AP today, Donald Trump said Thursday, if he wins the White House, he will fire Special Counsel Jack Smith, quote, within 2 seconds of taking office. Trump was asked during an interview with right-wing radio host Hugh Hewitt whether he would first pardon himself or terminate Smith to remove the legal cloud hanging over him. Smith, who was appointed by Attorney General Merrick Garland in 2022, has charged the former president with a series of felonies related to his efforts to steal the 2020 election and his theft of highly classified national security documents when he left the White House and then refusing to give them back to the government. Quote, it's so easy, said Trump. I would fire him within 2 seconds. He'll be one of the first things addressed. Trump called Smith a, quote, crooked person. If elected, of course, he could order the Justice Department to remove Jack Smith. AP explains that he probably would not be able to do it on his own because Smith is not a presidential appointee. But again, you know, presidents no longer have to follow the actual rule of law, at least according to Chief Justice John Roberts and the rest of Trump's corrupted U.S. Supreme Court majority. When Trump while president was investigated by special counsel Robert Mueller, Trump urged his then White House counsel Don McGahn to press the DOJ to terminate Mueller. McGahn, to his credit, at least on this point, refused to do so. Of course, contrast that, what Trump did, and what he's telling us he's going to do if he's allowed back into the White House, with what Joe Biden did when he took office, as his own son was already under federal investigation by Trump-appointed prosecutors. Biden allowed them to stay on. He did not fire them, as he could have. And as his own son was eventually charged and convicted in two different felony indictments, he's now facing potential jail time. So, yeah, Joe Biden could have had that prosecutor fired and ordered the investigation killed. He could have also pardoned his son at any time over the past nearly 4 years. He did none of those things. Do you think that Donald Trump would have done the same thing if Barack Obama's prosecutors, for example, had been investigating Ivanka Trump when Trump took office? Smith has brought two federal cases against the disgraced former president, one accusing him of illegally retaining classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. That was dismissed in July, at least for now. That decision is Smith is appealing that decision. The other, charging him with plotting to overturn the 2020 election, has been delayed by a friendly Supreme Court opinion conferring broad immunity for official acts made while president. After Trump said that he would fire Jack Smith, Hewitt on the radio raised the possibility that Congress could impeach him for that. Trump said he did not believe it would happen. He said, "I don't think they'll impeach me if I fire Jack Smith." While Trump criticized Smith, he praised U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon, the Trump-appointed judge who dismissed the classified documents case down in Florida. Back in July, on absurd grounds that, as noted, Smith is appealing, an appeal that could also, by the way, be ordered away if Donald Trump manages to win again this year. Quote, "We have a brave, brilliant judge in Florida," Trump told Hewitt on Thursday. "She's a brilliant judge, by the way. I don't know her. I never spoke to her," he took pains to say. "Never spoke to her. But we had a brave and brilliant, very brilliant judge." That brave and very brilliant judge, by the way, who has already had her own rulings in this case overturned twice by the very conservative 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. She is apparently, reportedly anyway, on Trump's short list to become the next Attorney General of the United States if he wins. Let's take a quick break here. We got a few more items of note on Trump's dictatorial fascist authoritarianism from his previous term in office, wherein we learned, well, the enemies within, apparently they are you. As well as more on Kamala's closing arguments, Desi's Green News Report, and a few words of encouragement to help us all get through these next, as I said, probably very bumpy days between now and November 5. I'm Brad Friedman. You are listening to The Bradcast, Smartly Done.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
I'm telling these tears, go and follow away. May the last one burn into flames. Freedom, freedom, I can't move. Freedom, cut me loose. Yeah, freedom,
welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from BradBlog.com.
I break chains on
The legendary Beyonce, according to AP today, is expected to appear on Friday in her hometown of Houston at a rally for Vice President Kamala Harris. That, according to three people familiar with the matter. Harris's presidential campaign has taken on the iconic singer's freedom as its anthem, and the singer's planned appearance brings a high level of star power to what has become a key theme of the Democratic nominee's bid. That would be freedom. Harris will head to the reliably Republican state, Desi's old home state.
Yep.
Just 10 days before Election Day, in an effort to refocus her campaign against former President Trump on reproductive care, which Democrats see as a make-or-break issue this year. And she's doing so in a state where Democratic Congressman Colin Allred is mounting a very serious challenge for the U.S. Senate against Texas's lovable Republican senator.
The cuddly Ted Cruz.
Ted Cruz, that's right. Speculation,
cuddly,
by the way,
little backstabber.
Over whether the superstar would appear at this summer's DNC in Chicago reached a fever pitch on the final night, thanks to online rumors, after TMZ had falsely suggested as much in its reporting. And of course, by the way, with Beyonce joining Harris this week, it seems to me that there's really only one even bigger star left. So they must be keeping a Taylor Swift on hold somewhere for an appearance in the final week of the campaign, because you know the old saying, it ain't over till the cat lady sings. So a few weeks ago on the broadcast and the Green News Report, as Trump was busy falsely claiming that the Biden-Harris administration was withholding FEMA disaster aid from Republican-leaning areas following Hurricanes Helene and Milton, we covered how Trump, in his first term as president, actually attempted to withhold FEMA wildfire disaster aid to all of us out here in California. Former Trump White House aides then revealed that Trump refused to grant aid, the aid request to a Democratic-leaning California until he was finally shown data by his own aides how many voters in this state had actually voted for him, including in the disaster areas. Recently, Trump again threatened to use disaster aid to punish his political opponents, who he describes as the enemies within. He did so during an October 12 rally in California, where Trump said he would withhold wildfire assistance from the state unless the state's Democratic governor, Gavin Newsom, agreed to accept Trump's demands to increase agriculture water supplies by weakening endangered species protections.
We're going to take care of our farmers. We're going to take care of your water situation. And we'll force it down his throat. And we'll say, Gavin, if you don't do it, we're not giving you any of that fire money that we send you all the time for all the forest fires that you have.
So he doesn't mind using the office of the presidency to threaten his political enemies, like a governor. And yes, millions of people in the state of California. So on Thursday, E&E News revealed previously unreported incidents of Trump during his time in the White House actually withholding aid from a whole bunch of other states, run by people with whom he had political disagreements. They note in early September 2020, for example, wildfires tore through eastern Washington state, obliterating tens of millions of dollars of property, displacing hundreds of rural residents, and killing a one-year-old boy. But an E&E News investigation reveals today that then-President Donald Trump refused to act on Washington State Governor Jay Inslee's request for $37 million in federal disaster aid because of a bitter personal dispute that Trump had with the Democratic governor. So Trump sat on Inslee's request for the final 4 months of his presidency, delaying recovery, leaving communities unsure about rebuilding because nobody knew if they were going to get federal help. Trump ignored Inslee's 73-page request even after FEMA found during weeks of inspection that the fires easily met the federal damage threshold for disaster aid. Inslee said in a recent interview with E&E, quote, "It really was an outrageous abuse of power." The two men had been feuding in the months leading up to the fire, with Trump calling Inslee, quote, "a snake," and a, quote, "nasty person," and, quote, "failed presidential candidate." Yeah, that sounds like Trump. After the governor had criticized the administration's handling of the coronavirus pandemic, Trump's spurning of Washington state, documented by internal emails, letters, federal records, interviews, is the latest example of how the former president used disaster requests to punish political foes, or as he likes to call them now, the enemy within. Which I guess includes not only the governor of Washington, but all of the Americans in Washington state who were punished by Trump as well.
Punishing disaster victims who just happened to live in the wrong place.
Now, for the record, President Biden ultimately approved Inslee's request after taking office 141 days after Inslee had made the request. The time span, which is nearly 5 months, is the longest it has ever taken a president to approve any disaster request. The average time period for presidential approval is 17 days. This was 141 days. But E&E News found other previously unreported examples of Trump denying or delaying disaster aid to governors who had criticized him. Trump learned that there was political value in these disasters after Hurricane Harvey had overwhelmed part of Texas back in 2017. Time magazine wrote a flattering account of the administration's response at the time. That, according to Mark Harvey, who was Trump's senior director for resilience policy on the National Security Council staff, quote, "It really got stuck in his mind at that point of disaster response that showing up and doing this disaster theater is a way for him to garner support and a way for him to be admired. And that feeds into his personality," said Harvey, who, by the way, like so many other former Trump administration officials, is now supporting Vice President Kamala Harris for president. Harvey said that as Trump's presidency continued, he more frequently delayed disaster aid based on factors that had nothing to do with helping to clean up and rebuild. Quote, "It was what looks good for me, not what's the right thing to do," said Harvey. E&E News found instances that fit the pattern described by Harvey in which Trump, after he lost the 2020 election, then delayed or ignored requests for disaster aid from governors who had criticized him. In the battleground state of Georgia, on November 21, 2020, just 3 days after asking Trump for disaster aid to recover from a tropical storm, Republican Governor Brian Kemp of Georgia enraged Trump by certifying the election results, declaring Biden the winner. Trump, who had been urging Kemp and the Georgia Secretary of State to declare him the winner in Georgia, assailed the governor as a, quote, "moron and nut job." He then sat on the disaster request for 55 days before finally approving it with 8 days left in his term. Kemp, who actually is a moron, by the way, has endorsed Trump anyway and has appeared at campaign rallies with him. He declined comment for the E&E story for some reason. In Utah, Trump took 97 days to approve a disaster request by then Utah Governor Gary Herbert, a Republican, following damaging storms in October of 2020, despite a FEMA report showing the state sustained twice as much damage as needed to meet the threshold for the aid. While Trump was considering the request, Herbert was one of the first Republican officials to recognize Joe Biden as the election winner. So apparently that was the sin. He recognized the truth that Joe Biden had won the election. Therefore, let's withhold aid to him and his people in his state. Yes, people of Utah, he considers you to be the enemy within. And in Maryland, Trump took no action. None on a November 12, 2020 request for aid by Maryland Governor Larry Hogan after a tropical storm caused damage the FEMA said was sufficient to qualify for federal aid. Hogan, who is a moderate Republican in a heavily Democratic state, assailed Trump's handling of COVID-19. Hogan, who is running for U.S. Senate this year, also did not respond to E&E News
for some reason.
Yeah. After President Biden finally approved the request on February 4, 2021, days after taking office, but months after originally requested, Maryland's Emergency Management Agency Director testified at a congressional hearing that the, quote, delay caused us to miss opportunities to strengthen the state against future disasters, adding citizens do not have the ability to wait months to receive assistance and return to their homes and businesses. Trump campaign and former Trump officials also did not respond to E&E's request for comment on any of this for some reason. And that's the guy that voters in states like California, Georgia, Utah, Maryland, and by the way, all the other 46 are actually considering returning to office. Really? Are they? And speaking of the ever-increasing number of disasters in our climate-changed world, we'll have a bit more for you after this. But first, let's get to our latest Green News Report.
Some in the tri-state area are calling this month Drytober. Cities like New York and Philadelphia could see their first October on record with zero rainfall.
Record heat and drought fuel wildfires in the Northeast. U.S. Senate majority and the future of climate action hang in the balance of this year's election. Plus,
we are deploying clean energy.
Biden administration racing the clock to allocate climate and infrastructure funding.
All that clock racing and more straight ahead from BrandBlog.com. I'm Brand Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
They want to do things like no windows in buildings. They have some wonderful plans for this country.
Oh, no, you're confused, sir. They were talking about your jail cell. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen. So they are still fighting the flooding from Hurricane Milton down in Florida?
It's crazy, but yes, parts of Central Florida are still grappling with persistent flooding from devastating Hurricane Milton 2 weeks after landfall.
Really?
It's another reminder that hurricane impacts remain a threat long after the storm. The state health department confirms that after Hurricanes Helene and Milton, several counties in Florida are now seeing a surge in infections of Vibrio fulminatus.
Yikes.
A flesh-eating bacteria that thrives in warm coastal waters and floodwaters.
Double yikes.
An unusually hot October across the U.S. now, 85% of the lower 48 is seeing above-average temperatures. In the Northeast, there's been virtually no rainfall in some states in October, and drought and record-high temperatures are fueling an outbreak of wildfires.
In the Northeast.
Yes, numerous studies show that man-made climate change is increasing the frequency, size, and intensity of wildfires everywhere. New Jersey Fire Service Chief Greg McLaughlin on NBC News confirms that fire season there has changed.
Fire seasons are not seasonal anymore, and they've actually become year-round.
So it's interesting that that's the case in both the Northeast and out here in the West. Fire season all year round.
Yes, that's the world of climate change. In politics, in the critical November election, control of the U.S. Senate and the future of U.S. climate and industrial policy hang in the balance.
Oh, that's all?
In a recent debate in Michigan's U.S. Senate race, former Republican Representative Mike Rogers said he would repeal President Biden's landmark climate law, the Inflation Reduction Act, and block federal incentives that help Michigan automakers transition to electric vehicles, and he called for repealing tailpipe pollution and emission standards. Democratic Senate candidate Representative Alyssa Slotkin said those incentives are critical to maintaining U.S. global competitiveness.
If the fundamental question is who do we want to make that next generation of vehicles, you better believe I want that to be Michigan and not China. Right now, everyone knows China is eating our lunch on these kind of vehicles.
I should also note that the Republican candidate Mike Rogers called for an end to Joe Biden's EV mandate.
But there is no EV mandate.
What?
In Florida's U.S. Senate race, incumbent Republican Senator Rick Scott refuses to even acknowledge climate change, even in the wake of multiple destructive hurricanes. And as governor, he once banned the words climate change from state agencies. Whereas former Democratic House Representative Debbie Mercosell Powell supports climate action and funding resilient infrastructure.
Does Rick Scott not remember the two hurricanes that hit his state just about 2 weeks ago?
Apparently not. Meanwhile, the Biden administration is pushing forward with innovation and racing to deploy climate and infrastructure funding. The Interior Department this week approved a massive advanced geothermal energy project in Utah, a significant milestone for a zero-carbon technology that provides clean 24/7 baseload energy on par with nuclear power plants.
Cool.
Minus the uranium mining and radioactive nuclear waste.
Even cooler.
The Department of Energy approved a $52 million grant to convert a closed coal plant in a rural community in Utah into a factory that will use mine waste to make next-generation low-carbon concrete to decarbonize cement, one of the most carbon-intensive materials in the world.
Wow.
And finally, the Department of Energy also funded the first-ever tribal microgrid project with long-duration battery storage in Southern California, which will also support the largest single EV charging hub in North America.
This is all pretty cool and could all come to a crashing halt depending on how people vote on November 5. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Don't give up on us, baby. Don't
that make song.
Right.
Don't give up on us, baby. Thank you very much, Desi Doyen.
Yes.
Before we go, since I realize a lot of folks are you know, watching way too much cable news out there and following the pre-election polls way too closely.
Doom scrolling on social
yes,
media.
Yes. A few closing thoughts today from Kamala Harris at the this is from the end of one of her three town halls over the past week. This one in Birmingham, Michigan, I think, in suburban Detroit. Three town halls with the very conservative Republican former congresswoman turned Kamala Harris endorser, Liz Cheney. She closed with an optimistic message, which I think we could all use today for how best for all of us to get through the next coming very bumpy days until Election Day. In which she focused on the message, do not despair.
We cannot despair. We cannot despair. You know, the nature of a democracy is such that I think there's a duality. On the one hand, there's an incredible strength when our democracy is intact, an incredible strength in what it does to protect the freedoms and rights of its people. Oh, there's great strength in that. And it is very fragile. It is only as strong as our willingness to fight for it. And so that's the moment we're in. And I say do not despair because in a democracy, as long as we can keep it, in our democracy, the people, every individual has the power to make a decision about what this will be. And so let's not feel powerless. Let's not let the overwhelming nature of this all make us feel powerless, because then we have been defeated. And that's not our character as the American people. We are not one to be defeated. We rise to a moment, and we stand on broad shoulders of people who have fought this fight before for our country. And in many ways, let us look at the challenge then that we are being presented and not be overwhelmed by it. The baton is now in our hands to fight for, not against, but for this country we love. That's what we have the power to do. So let's own that. Dare I say, be joyful in what we will do in the process of owning that, which is knowing that we can and will build community and coalitions and remind people that we're all in this together. Let's not let the overwhelming nature of this strip us of our strength. That's how I feel about this.
That's how I feel about this, too.
Me, too.
Kamala Harris in Birmingham, Michigan this week with a message worth keeping in mind, no matter how dark and grim all of this feels at times. Anyway, we have got to get out. My thanks to Desi Doyen, our producer. My thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or want to hear it again or want to share it with someone you know, you love, you hate, you can do that for free anytime via bradblog.com. We've got no paywall there. Why? Thanks to you and at least those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. We are 100% listener supported. So for that, I thank you. Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com and you'll find me on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter at the Brad Blog. That's it. We'll see you at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Don't give up on us, baby. We're still worth one more try. I know we put a last one by just for a rainy evening. When maybe stars are few, don't give up on us, I know. We can still come through.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.